Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning Public Affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, our stations have been proud to partner with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence as they've rolled out and developed their Lethality Assessment Program, or LAP. And today we're joined by the agency's Director of Law Enforcement Services in recognition that this life-saving and life-changing intervention is now in place with every single law enforcement agency in Connecticut. Then we're going to call on all Connecticut residents to play a role in the future development and preservation of the state's recreational sites and facilities by reading and commenting on the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan. And we'll close chatting about Harmony for Kids and all the incredible work they've done in the past decade and how the nonprofit is engaging college students to help in transforming and enriching the lives of children and creating doors of opportunity for them through music and the arts. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. Yeah, tax time is coming, and AARP Foundation Tax Aid is looking to expand its team of volunteers for the upcoming tax season here in Connecticut. Tax Aid offers free tax filing help to anyone, especially those 50 and older who can't afford a tax preparation service. Tax Aid volunteers make a difference in their communities by assisting many older, lower-income taxpayers who might otherwise miss out on the credits and deductions they've earned. Tax Aid volunteers receive training and support in a welcoming environment, and there's a need for volunteer tax preparers, client facilitators, those who can provide technical and management assistance, and interpreters. Every level of experience is welcome. To learn about these volunteer opportunities, visit aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. Add an E at the end. That's TAXAIDE. Well, it hasn't been too long since we talked with our friends from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and oftentimes it's prompted by bad news in the media. Fortunately, today, although it's related to the unfortunate activities around domestic violence, we're celebrating some good news for the organization. Very recently, the Coalition and the Connecticut Police Officer Standards and Training Council released their Connecticut Lethality Assessment Program report, and Connecticut is not only the first state to implement that LAP statewide in the country, but this lethality practice, Connecticut has really been a leader in inspiring many other law enforcement agencies, states, and counties to initiate this practice as well. I'm pleased to bring Dan Cargill on. He's retired from Connecticut State Police, and he's the Director of Law Enforcement Services for the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And we're here today to talk a little more in depth about that assessment tool that so many law enforcement agencies are using and now Connecticut is using throughout all of its law enforcement agencies, and Dan's work on the Lethality Review Task Force. Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
John, thank you very much for having me.
So before we get into the information and background on what you do on the task force, remind folks about this really effective tool that has now been implemented virtually statewide.
Certainly. So the Lethality Assessment Program, or LAP as we call it, is a two-pronged tool that law enforcement uses during the investigation of a intimate partner domestic violence situation. The first piece of this two-pronged tool is the actual screen, which is 11 questions that was developed by Dr. Jackie Campbell of Johns Hopkins University. And this is a risk assessment tool that is utilized throughout Connecticut, or at least a piece of the tool is used throughout Connecticut in judicial and in a number of states across the country. We are the first state, or currently the only state, that is utilizing LAP in all departments. And then the second piece of that tool, after law enforcement asks the 11 questions at that moment, the second piece is, depending upon the score and the answers the victim gave, law enforcement would then contact the local domestic violence program and put the victim in contact with the program immediately right there at that time, at the time of their greatest risk.
Mm-hmm. And the purpose behind this is taking a already well-developed initiative that many law enforcement agencies in Connecticut have adopted, kind of really changing the game on how they respond to domestic and intimate partner violence situations, and supplying them literally, as we said earlier, with a tool that helps them quickly identify and are able to actually go the extra step and intervene to some degree.
Absolutely. And the reality is, years ago, before LAP was brought to Connecticut, law enforcement would hand a victim of domestic violence a form with a number of numbers on it, and they would suggest that they think about contacting the Office of Victim Services for some help. And being one of those officers who handed out at least 100 of them, I always walked away with that empty feeling of thinking there could be something more that could be done. And this here with Lethality Assessment Program not only informs the victim, it informs officers of the potential lethality and the behavior that had occurred prior to the investigation that they were currently conducting.
Mm-hmm.
So it really lends a glimpse into the history of the relationship.
As this assessment questionnaire has been integrated and proliferated throughout a number of virtually all of law enforcement departments in Connecticut, and you in your capacity have been traveling around and networking and interacting with other law enforcement frontline and supervisors, are you hearing that as the officer stands there with the victim and they're actually going through the program, that showing them the propensity for further and more dire violence to be done on these people is actually playing a role in helping push them to take that phone and make that call and get that help?
Absolutely. And you know, to reiterate, the screen is a piece that is done after the investigation for the call that they are there for in the first place. So after that call and the investigation is completed, the officers are trained to say, look, based upon the circumstances I was here originally for, I have concerns about your safety and some of the things that you mentioned, and I would like to get a better sense of what has been going on, your relationship. And they ask them if it's okay to ask them a series of questions. And again, there are only the 11 questions, but they are vitally important. And again, they are the research-based and evidence-based tools that have been proven over the course of a 20-year research by Dr. Jackie Campbell.
Hmm. So when the victims are run through the questionnaire and the results do indicate that they should have immediate intervention, does having that sort of evidence right in front of them bolster their confidence that they do need the help? Is that can we call that a game changer in terms of the way the victims sort of are exposed to this information and intervention?
Absolutely, and victims have reported that after listening to the officer and going through the questions and having the officer look at them and say the words, other people that have been in your situation who have answered yes to similar questions just like you did have been killed. So that statement really opens the eyes and makes victims realize the true dangerousness of their situation, which has impacted them greatly in their decision making.
Right. Well, aside from the latest report virtually celebrating the fact that all Connecticut law enforcement agencies are now using this lethality assessment program, are there...
I just want to add that they're utilizing the LAP program voluntarily. This is not a mandated
tool. Right, right.
Not legislative.
Yeah.
This is a volunteer program, which they have seen the value in this.
Yeah.
And it does take a little extra time for law enforcement to do it, but it is a valuable tool.
Yeah, and as I have reported on and talked to both frontline officers and supervisors and trainers about this tool over the past few years, they have also expressed similar sentiments that you did earlier on. It was especially the veterans, the 10, 20, 25 year guys and women who so often walked away from the situation, shaking their head with the fear in their heart that the next call that they went to that address was going to be accompanied by the medical examiner,
Correct.
So anything else in this report that is important to talk about before we spend a couple minutes talking about the future good work of the task force?
Well, just here in the state of Connecticut, the results of the report and what the victims are reporting in terms of behavior is consistent. Not only here in Connecticut, but nationally, 76% of the people that were screened in said yes, there is jealousy and control in the relationship, and that is the center hub of the domestic violence wheel. And being separated or leaving is another huge indicator, as well as being choked or being stalked or spied upon or threatened. Those three areas with the jealousy and control are consistent messages and consistent answers victims are giving. So if you think of that from a behavioral standpoint, we are no different than many other states in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we turn our attention to your work on the Lethality Review Task Force, one of the things I'm interested in knowing about, whether it's anecdotal or actually part of your work at this point, is the impact of social networks, especially these sort of hard to track social networks that young people are engaged in. I mean, the last time Karen Jarmak, your executive director, was on this program, we were reeling in my neighborhood in Waterbury from the death of a mother and her young daughter at the hands of an intimate partner. And just a couple of days ago, we heard of another situation with a 20-something gentleman and a 16-year-old girl who was shot in a vehicle, presumably in a domestic or intimate partner violence situation. Are you finding that social networks are not helping when it comes to the stalking and control that goes on between the victims and the perpetrators?
Certainly with social media, there are dozens of ways to identify or to track somebody, or even if you simply are checking in at a restaurant or taking a picture of a particular location or item in a location. There are geotags that will identify exactly where that picture was taken from and at what time. So social media plays a huge part in the ability for stalkers to keep track of the people they are trying to stalk.
Hmm. Is this something that the task force either has been or you anticipate will be paying a lot more attention to in the coming months and years?
Well, as technology progresses, we will certainly keep an eye on all technologies. And today's day and age, with the abilities of technology and the proliferation of the ability to track people, whether it's a free app on the internet or a paid-for service, we're certainly going to keep an eye on that.
Very good. In the last couple minutes that we have with you then, Dan Cargill, tell us what is in store for the task force and what other things are you all looking at for the coming year?
Well, certainly. So our Fatality Review Task Force will be releasing a report in September of 2018. We release a report every 2 years, and this will encompass the 2000 and 2016 and 2017 session, where we reviewed or have reviewed approximately 18 homicides, intimate partner domestic violence homicides. So that we look forward to seeing what recommendations come out of this review, and we look forward to releasing our report.
Dan Cargill is the Director of Law Enforcement Services for the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. They're the state's leading voice for victims of domestic violence and those who serve them. If you would like to get in touch with them, if you know someone, or if you are or even think you're a victim of domestic violence, help is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The state hotline toll-free is 888-774-2900. And if you'd like to learn more about the organization or review this latest report, you can go to ctcadv.org. Dan, thanks so much for your time this morning, and best of luck and happy holidays. Well, every once in a while, probably like 5 or 6 times a year, we check in with the folks at the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and we're pleased to make the acquaintance of Michael Lambert. He's DEEP's Bureau Chief of Outdoor Recreation, and I was recently contacted to help facilitate public feedback on the department's recent plan called SCORP, that is the Statewide Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan. They are in a public review and comment period. You can access that and kind of sing along with us if you'd care to, or go on and review it to the extent you'd like, and then provide your comments back to the DEEP by just going to ct.gov/DEEP/SCORP. And with that, let's bring Michael on the line. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Good, good. Thanks good. For doing this. You know, it's funny. Just earlier this week, somewhere in the world of everything I read and hear and see, I came across a piece of news indicating that one of the biggest draws for individuals in Connecticut is the recreational space that Connecticut offers, and particularly its trail and hiking systems. So I guess in some part that kind of harkens as to why it's important for the state to be developing this outdoor recreation plan, since it, Connecticut's outdoor environment is such an important thing. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what the Outdoor Recreation Bureau does.
Well, thank you. I think we're pretty fortunate here in Connecticut. And with the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, we're responsible for the conservation and management of statewide recreation lands and resources for public use. And in Connecticut, these lands and resources consist of over 255,000 acres of state parks, forest, and boating access areas. And so our primary goal in the Bureau is to provide public use and access that is compatible with the long-term protection of our state's natural resources. And this is something we take very seriously and work hard to balance the variety of outdoor recreation interests while also protecting the state's natural resources.
And are you an environmental scientist, or what's your how did you get into all this?
Well, my background, I'm an earth scientist. I was an earth science major in college, spent 21 years with North Carolina State Parks, started out as a park ranger, and moved to Connecticut a little over 4 years to go in the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation.
It's so interesting that as I have come across dozens and dozens of DEP and DEEP representatives, that so many of them, I want to say like probably 8 out of 10 of them, started either as you know, lifeguards or park rangers, or working in their local municipal parks and recreation department in some form from childhood or their teen years, or not much later than their college years, and then you know, they've been lucky enough to find careers in those fields, and I guess you're the next in that long line of folks who kind of started out that way.
Well, I think we're pretty fortunate in this line of work. The people that are drawn to this, they They care about the environment. They believe in the mission of the agency, and they work very hard. So I feel fortunate to work with the folks I do.
Hmm. So how are we doing in Connecticut in terms of, you know, from your department's perspective, in terms of preserving and maintaining this these many acres of open space and recreational areas? Are we statistically on par with a lot of our other neighboring states here in the Northeast in terms of the proportion of space that we preserve and make available for folks development free?
Well, in my opinion, I think it's pretty remarkable that we have the amount of public lands that we do in this state. I know Connecticut is a small state, but you know, when you compare the size of the state and the amount of acreage that's available in parks and forests, you know, we're pretty fortunate here. And we also have a variety of natural resources, you know, from the shoreline to the Connecticut River Valley to the western hills, northwestern hills. We have, you know, quite a bit of variety in our natural resources. So I think it's pretty special here that we have that.
Hmm. Have you been hearing about this push to attract more people to the state and the popularity of the ability to traverse many of these open spaces by visitors and tourists as well as residents of Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I'm aware of that, and, I think there's a great opportunity to promote that. Most people have a tendency not to visit the parks and forests in their backyard, but, there's a tremendous resource right here in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, as the importance of getting out of the chair and walking, even on a limited basis, continues to grow in terms of a health practice, and as we all continue to age and kind of get out of the extreme sports world of activities, it seems like Connecticut is really the place to be when it comes to providing a lot of opportunities for folks to get some nice passive recreation in on our open space. Tell me now about the development or the inception of this SCORP plan.
Well, SCORP is developed as a requirement of the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund, and this program provides matching grants to states and municipalities for the development of park and recreation lands and facilities. And the National Park Service administers the program and requires each participating state to complete an outdoor recreation plan every 5 years. And the plans have very specific requirements, and you know, they've got to be comprehensive and identify outdoor recreation issues of statewide importance based on public input. The plans evaluate demand and public outdoor recreation preferences, and then also evaluate the supply of recreation resources.
And so this is the next in a series of five-year check-ins, so to speak?
Correct. And this is our vision. This is our strategic plan over the next 5 years. So that's how we set the plan up. We look at a five-year window.
Mm-hmm. Is there also some parallel plan or at least practice to not only use SCORP in the immediate or relative immediacy of 5 years, but also some other sort of dual initiative that looks out 10, 20, 50 years as well that's maintained or that your department contributes to?
Yes, we have, there's a variety of plans, but primarily our park master plans are more of that, long-term vision.
Yeah.
50-year vision. We also complete general management plans for each park unit, and that's more of a short-term time frame, similar to SCORP, but more specific to the unit itself. And then one of the things we hope that will come out of this SCORP is that, you know, it's also referenced in, you know, other plans across the state, whether it be plans within our agency or, you know, plans outside in land trust and mm-hmm. local Parks and Rec, so other organizations as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the broad variety of partners that kind of come to the table over this initiative of preserving and protecting our open space, which is, better to strengthen numbers, so to speak, versus being out there on your own maintaining it. Folks, we want to remind you that the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and their 2017 through 2022 statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan is available for public review and comment right now. If you'd like to check that out, you can go to ct.gov/DEEP/SCORP. We are on the line with Michael Lambert. He's Bureau Chief for the Outdoor Recreation Division of the department. And we are talking about this SCORP plan. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about some of the important goals and action items that are on this plan and a little bit more background before we send Michael off for this morning. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a couple moments. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Community Foundation for Greater New Haven has just announced two grant opportunities with the application deadlines coming up in January. The Community Fund for Women and Girls is accepting applications for their 2018 grant cycle through Thursday, January 18th to help underwrite gender-specific initiatives that are intentional, equitable, and well-informed. Also, the Quinnipiac River Fund, a component fund of the Community Foundation, is accepting applications through Monday, January 22nd for projects designed to benefit the environmental quality of the Quinnipiac River, the New Haven Harbor, and surrounding watersheds. Approximately $100,000 in grants are awarded each spring from the fund. For more information, just head to the foundation's website to get started by clicking on cfgnh.org. Well, we're back. Thanks for sticking with us. Michael Lambert's on the line with us. He's Bureau Chief for the Outdoor Recreation Division of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We are talking about SCORP. That is the Statewide Comprehensive Recreation Plan. This is a planning document that identifies outdoor recreation issues of statewide significance and evaluates the supply and demand for outdoor recreation. They are in their public comment period for their latest draft, and they're interested in having you take a look at it and perhaps commenting on it to help influence the direction that DEEP goes in the next 5 years with their outdoor recreation initiatives. You can go to ct.gov/DEEP/SCORP to review and comment. So, Michael, thanks for sticking with us as well.
Thank you, John.
The SCORP includes four key goals and action items that represent the commitment by DEEP to continue to be responsive to the recreation needs of Connecticut and people who come here to visit. Talk a little bit about the development of those goals and anything else that is important for folks to know as they download or review this plan and anticipate commenting.
Well, thank you, John. The goals were chosen based on the need to build upon past success and previous SCORP documents that the agency completed. And we also used the public surveys as a building block to develop the next 5-year plan, the strategic plan. And so in addition to those four broad goals that the public will be able to see when they log on to the website, there are general strategies and objectives to support each one of those. And then within that, there's also supportive data to guide and measure progress towards the mission of the SCORP. And so each goal will have several strategies and objectives and that will provide direction and allocation of resources over a period of time.
So I see one of them is, of course, to protect and conserve and manage Connecticut's natural environment. But that goal also includes cultural and historical resources. I'm interested in how the cultural fits into all that.
Well, one of the things that the survey revealed was that a great number of Connecticut citizens visit historic sites. Walking and hiking were the most popular land-based recreation activities, with 86% of households participating in that over the last 12 months. But also in that, there were 54% of households that enjoyed visiting historic sites. And so we felt it necessary to address those survey results in our goals.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of what you might call, cultural or even like entertainment related venues that are either part of or abut DEP or state open space or recreation areas?
Well, we have tremendous historic resources in this state, and we're fortunate to manage those with our State Parks Division. And part of that goal is to better interpret that to the public. You know, there's such tremendous history here, and one of those goals is we want to tell the story, and we want to do a better job interpreting those that message to the public. So that's how that falls within that goal.
Oh, okay. The next item is providing clean, safe, well-maintained outdoor recreation areas and facilities. Both present a challenge in terms of budgeting, human resources, and capital development. Are there any indications at this point of where Connecticut stands in terms of its availability of facilities to support the positive and robust use of our recreational sites?
Yeah, I think the survey revealed some interesting information on that. The survey assessed through ratings given by Connecticut citizens that nearly 87% of respondents rated local parks as good or excellent, and about the same proportion, 88%, issued good or excellent ratings for state parks. And this marks an increase from the 2005 score. So, that's right in line with the survey results, and we wanted to capitalize on that and improve.
Mm. The next item, which I have a feeling is going to yield sort of the same positive outcomes in the survey, is ensuring all residents and visitors can locate and access all outdoor recreation areas and facilities. Your department in particular, and the state on par, has done such an amazing job in utilizing technology to help folks get information, contribute information. You know, we're asking for them to use electronic medium to help support and comment on this report. But tell us a little bit about how your department has worked up to now to utilize technology to help folks find the recreation areas and sites that they're looking for.
Well, the primary source for that is our division website. Our State Parks Division website is an excellent resource for information on the variety of state park properties that are out there. We think there's opportunities to identify those other outlying parcels that, you know, may be closer to someone's residence that they may be able to take advantage of. And one of the things the survey revealed is that people have a tendency to recreate close to home, and bringing more awareness to those resources that are available close to home, I think, will be an advantage to us over the next 5 years.
Hmm. Can you say at this point that every single parcel or facility or site that is under the management of DEEP is highlighted somewhere within the electronic data world of your department?
Yeah, pretty much every parcel is available on the website, and I think, you know, some parks and properties have more information than others, of course, but, I think for us, it's just bringing that awareness and consistency of how we promote those to the public will be an advantage to us.
Hmm. And coming all the way back around to our first couple minutes speaking this morning, the final goal and action item is to promote healthy lifestyles through increased participation in outdoor recreation. Sort of a no-brainer, but tell us a little bit about what you learned in the most recent survey and what folks will learn in the draft about how well DEEP in your office is working toward helping people understand and find these sites so that they can participate in some hiking or cross-country skiing or swimming to improve their own health.
Yeah, well, I think, again, when folks have an opportunity to review the survey, there's quite a bit of information there about the preferences of avid outdoor enthusiasts and Connecticut citizens on how they recreate. And, you know, it was not surprising that walking and hiking is still the most popular recreation activity. And, you know, we want to ensure that we're engaging with local schools. We are very active in the No Child Left Inside program, encouraging families and children to come outdoors and enjoy the resources that there are available here in our agency. So we'll continue to promote that through the goals. Look forward to feedback from the public on initiatives that we could build upon with any of these goals. So I think it's a good opportunity. I think it's great to, for us to have you know, fresh eyes on the plan, and it's I know we've already received quite a few comments on the plan so far, over 30 comments. So I look forward to that feedback.
Yeah. Now, we've been saying throughout the program that folks go to ct.gov/DEEP/SCORP to access and review the draft. Can they click through right from that draft to provide comments?
Actually, there's the plan on the website, but there's also an email address where they can send their comments to an email. And that's, I can provide that. It's deep.scorp@ct.gov.
Very good. And as we broadcast this segment on December 10th, time is of the essence. There is a looming deadline for folks under which you'd like to get their comments.
Absolutely. The sooner we can get the comments, the better. And you know, we're actively involved with finalizing the report, and look forward to the feedback we get.
Okay, I'm looking at December 28th. Is that sort of a soft deadline for folks to get their comments in, or is that pretty much you know, after that point they may not be incorporated?
That's a firm deadline. We definitely need comments before then, because we have our own deadline with the National Park Service to provide the report to them for their review.
Very good. Well, folks, it's up to you now. If you would like to comment on the next 5 years of how your Department of Energy and Environmental Protection works to develop comprehensive outdoor recreation initiatives, the time is now. You have until December 28th. To go to ct.gov/DEEP/SCORP to review and make your comments. And we appreciate your time this morning. Michael Lambert is Bureau Chief for the Outdoor Recreation Division at the department, and he is a co-author or contributor to this draft report, and was kind enough to come on and tell us all about it this morning. So, Michael, great to meet you, and thank you so much for your time today. All right. It has been way too long since we caught up with Irina Hart Makarchuk. She is the founder of an organization called Harmony for Kids. That's Harmony, the number 4, KIDZ.org, if you're looking for them on the web. This organization transforms the lives of children through music and art, and they believe that the power of music can change the direction of a young life. And by doing that one child at a time, they are on a mission to make a powerful difference in the world. They celebrated their 10-year anniversary back in mid-September, and they are on an upward trajectory for 2018. As we speak to Irina today, we're just the morning after a big event, but we are also talking about that very first peace concert back in 2007 that started this whole ball rolling. Irina, thanks for joining us on the phone today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again.
So let's go back to 2007 and talk a little bit about this little spark of an idea that you had and how it's come so far in this in these 10 years. I remember you contacting me way back then and how this was just kind of like a little idea, maybe a one-off, and look where it's gone.
Yes, exactly. Well, it all started with the song, Save the World. The song came to me because I was so impacted by seeing the kids in Union Square Park that were living on the streets, homeless. And after I wrote the song, Save the World, I became extremely determined to do something and not just sit there and watch what was going on. So that's how Harmony for Kids came to be. And through trial and error, I'd say 4 years ago, I came into contact with Diane Wyckoff, who was the librarian at ABCD, and she connected me with about 1,400 youngsters. They have 14 locations, and with all these children, and the ages are much younger than where I started. They're 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old children. And we started developing music workshops for these children, and they just love these workshops. And as we developed them, we realized that this is our focus, this is our niche, to start very young, and that's how we're going to change these children's lives, by starting very early. And we have been able to develop these workshops quite successfully, and increase the amount of workshops that we're able to offer. And we're focusing right on Bridgeport area at the moment, but we're ready to roll it out to other areas.
That's great. Well, it's pretty much a foregone scientific fact that children, at no matter what age, who engage in the playing and practicing of a musical instrument are much more academically inclined and become much better both in school and socially. So certainly the fruits of your effort will make a positive difference and have and are making a positive difference in the life of every child that you have touched so far. It's also probably important to assert at this point that you mentioned, of course, the song you wrote that kind of got this whole Harmony for Kids thing started, but you are a musician yourself.
Yes, I am. I come from a musical family. My grandfather always played the piano. My mom plays the violin and the piano. And I love the piano. In fact, last night I played the piano for the first time out in public. I usually play the guitar. So that was my debut of a piano piece. And, you know, it was well received. And my daughter now also, she's 17 now, and she plays instruments and writes songs and sings. So it's definitely in our blood. It's a family kind of tradition, and it's very important to have music in your family. And that's one other area that we're developing is one of our board members, Greg Pacini. He taught his girls to play violin since age of 2, and he's developed a program where parents and children can, you know, play music together. And one thing is, I come from Europe, and one thing in Europe is, you know, families always go out together. The children and the parents, they go out together. And in America, it's a little different. You know, you get a babysitter and you just go out. So I'm really happy the way that during Harmony for Kids events, the families come, the children and the parents come. Last night, we had the parents and the children. Some of the children performed and some of the adults performed, but we involve the whole entire family. We don't have to have our parents get a babysitter. They just bring their children. And it feels very much like, you know, a European-style kind of event.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little unusual because people don't know what to make of it. Is it a talent show? What is it? Is it for kids? Is it for adults? But the more we do it, the more people, once they get to the event, they start to understand the beauty of doing it together as a family, you know, and it bonds the family. And I believe, like, after doing all this research, you know, looking at these kids, like, going back to, you know, Union Square, why are these kids on the street? You know, a lot of it, they have problems in their families. A lot of it, you know, by the time you find them on the street, it's a little bit too late. You've got to start early. And that's why, after doing extensive research on the cause, on the root cause of homelessness, we decided to start from a very early, early development. And it seems to be, you know, very successful, so we're going with it.
Great. For folks that may not be familiar with the organization, you were referring to this this big event that you had last night as we record this a few days prior to broadcast. What was that event that was so successful?
Yeah, we usually have an annual holiday benefit concert. For the past 4 years, we've had it at Fairfield Theater Company Stage 1. Usually we do it, you know, around the holiday time, December time. And, you know, we get all our local artists, our board members are all musicians, and then our friends to perform, some of our friends' children to perform. And, you know, we get the community together to raise awareness. Raise money, of course, for the charity, and come together in harmony, because, you know, Harmony for Kids, that name, Harmony stands for music. Harmony also stands for peace. Harmony stands for, you know, being one with, you know, good to the environment. So it has a lot of symbolism. And I feel that when the community comes together, that's when real change can happen.
Very good. Folks, if you're interested in learning more about the great work that Irina Hart Makarchuk is doing, you can go to harmonyforkids.org. That's harmony, the number 4, KIDZ.org. This is a 501c3 nonprofit, so of course any contributions you might deem to make to this organization here at the holiday time or any other time is fully tax deductible. And while the inception for this happened about 10 years ago this past September, the organization really officially came together as a legal nonprofit in 2009, and they're dedicated to transforming and enriching the lives of local children and creating doors of opportunity for them through music and the arts. Irina, now, you know, 9-10 years into this project, the first few children that came into Harmony for Kids programming are now either in their early teens or maybe even their early 20s. Tell us a little bit about a couple of the first proteges of your organization and how they have, in your opinion or in your observation, utilized this opportunity that you availed them to become involved in music, to either continue on and develop that talent through to today, or how they have used their musical experience as a springboard to other things.
Okay, yeah, well, I can give you one example. This young woman, Jessica, she lived in a group home in Bridgeport. We worked with Greater Bridgeport, GBAP, Greater Bridgeport Awareness Program, and they had women living in the group home, young teens. Jessica was very interested in getting a saxophone. So through our contributions, we got her a saxophone, and we got her a year's worth of lessons of the saxophone lessons, so that she actually performed at one of our shows, showcasing what she learned. And I believe today she moved on to going to college, and she's doing really well and succeeding in life, whereas before she was pretty depressed. She was separated from her sister, and she wasn't, you know, she wasn't a joyful and happy person. And today she's a much more adjusted and happier person. And I, you know, I can't attribute all of it because we got her the saxophone, but I think it really made a big difference for her that someone cared enough to do all that for her. And also she's got, you know, the skills that she could always pick up and just use for, you know, in her life, for the rest of her life.
So in your work with ABCD, which is another youth development consortium in the Fairfield County area, you have now been able to come into contact with, as you said, thousands of young people. How do you integrate your work and expose these young people to the work of Harmony for Kids? Do you utilize or partner with staff in the schools, or is this something where you kind of bring in both the instruments, programming, and those who will teach it kind of turnkey from outside?
Well, this is our plan. Right now, it's just myself going to the classes, and we have developed a workshop that works as a turnkey workshop that we can now offer to other teachers. At this moment, this is where we're going to start working with colleges. What I'd like to create next is internships or community service programs, and I'm starting with Fairfield University. So every college has, you know, a program where they have to do a community service to get credits for, you know, their major or whatnot. Every school has that. We would like to offer Harmony for Kids opportunities as an internship or as potential community service so that, say, musically inclined college students can then, we would connect them to an appropriate agency where there are young children, and we will give them the instruments and all the materials necessary to conduct these workshops. So they'll have the syllabus, they'll have a guitar and a keyboard and other materials needed, and they'll come into the class once a week. It's a four-week workshop, and this progressive workshop, and work with the kids. So this way we could roll it out and are able to, you know, make a bigger impact.
Are you looking?
It took us a while to get this to this point where we could make it a turnkey.
Yeah. Are you using your partnership with Fairfield University as sort of a beta to kind of tweak it and make sure you have it right? Or are you at the point now where you would also welcome inquiries from other colleges and universities in Connecticut?
Well, of course, I'm going to welcome any inquiries, but we are still in the beta site. We're still trying to get it going just once, you know, just to make sure that because, you know, there's a lot of things we have to be very mindful of. We have to get a lot of approvals and, you know, background checks and so on and so forth, because it's very, very important to maintain safety in the schools. Mm-hmm. So that being said, we have to be very, very mindful of a lot of parameters to make this a safe and enjoyable experience for all.
Great. In the last minute or two that we have with you, Irina Hart, tell us how folks can help. Your 501c3, all contributions to the organization are able to be deducted on tax, but are you looking for instruments, or you know, folks come across grandpa's old saxophone case in the attic? Are you a venue through which these folks might be able to put that saxophone in the hand of a young person like the one you talked about, whose life you helped change earlier in the program?
Yeah, absolutely. We get a lot of donations of instruments, and we do exactly what you just said. We'll gift them to the talented children that we're affiliated with that wouldn't be able to afford it. So yeah, we receive instrument donations. We also just received a huge art collection, and we did a silent auction on that. So art donations, art supply donations are welcome. Financial donations, we have, you know, you can just go on our website and donate money. We don't have a big overhead, so all our donations go 100% towards these workshops, you know, art workshops and music workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you're a music teacher or, you know, would like to volunteer, we also could definitely welcome any kind of, time that someone would like to volunteer.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Well, folks can learn about contacting you through your website. It's Harmony, the number 4, KIDZ.org, Harmony for Kids. Our guest this morning and one who has been on the program a number of times over the years, the 10 years since she was so touched and inspired by homeless youth that she saw on the streets of New York, and now is helping to save and improve the lives of those young people by putting them in touch with their own creativity through music. Harmony for Kids, of course, as we said, a 501c3 nonprofit. They'd welcome your donation. They're based in Fairfield, but are growing partnerships throughout the region, and they are dedicated to transforming and enriching the lives of local children and creating doors of opportunity for them through music and the arts. They are a Love CT grant recipient and have done great work with that donation, and we hope that folks listening will support you, Irina. Happy holidays and good luck, and we'll be talking to you again soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.